being here tonight. Tonight is the last in the series that we've called Jesus the Evidence. There comes a point in time with regard to any issue or any trial in a court of law where there has to be a decision. You come to the point where the evidence is presented, the case is closed, now it's time for the jury to give the verdict. And so tonight, that's what we're going to be looking at. We're going to be reviewing just briefly the evidence that we've looked at in summary form, and then talk about the various things that we've looked at and what the verdict is with regard to those things. First of all, when you think about a court of law, there are, in most cases of a serious nature, there's a right to a jury trial. A jury, of course, is a group of people, citizens from the community, that sit in a jury box. They listen to the evidence. Then they're instructed on the law by the judge in the case, and they go back and they deliberate in the jury room, and they decide the facts of the case, and they decide the persons, if it's a criminal case, guilt or innocence. If it's a civil case, they'll decide whether somebody's been negligent, whether they're liable, how much the damages are, those sorts of issues. And so, kind of in line with our theme in this series about Jesus, the evidence, we've looked at various pieces of evidence regarding Jesus, who he is, and the scriptures and their reliability and so forth. So we've put the evidence out there, and now each of us has to look at that. And one thing that's important about looking at any issue, whether you're on a jury or just in life, is impartiality, honesty. I mean, those are Christian values, to be honest and to be considerate, fully considering the evidence and not be biased one way or another about things, not prejudging things. None of us would want to go and be put on trial for some crime, for example, that we knew we didn't commit, but the jury, for whatever reason, doesn't like us. We know people on the jury that want to do us harm. None of us would feel comfortable with that situation. That would be a biased situation. And so in courts of law, a lot of things are done to try to make sure that the jury is impartial. They want to make sure that the jury doesn't know any of the parties involved in the case. They're not familiar with the circumstances of the case. They have no particular bias one way or another. And there's a process that the attorneys go through at the beginning of a trial to, talk to prospective jurors and weed ones out that maybe are biased. So impartiality is something that's important in a jury, important in deciding any issue. When it comes to the issues we've been talking about concerning who Jesus is and the evidence for him, one thing I wanted to emphasize is that each one of us is the jury. We're a jury of one. Each one of us has to decide who is Jesus. We have to look at the evidence, we have to weigh it, and then we have to make that decision for ourselves. Now, at the end of this lesson, I'm going to be talking about, in particular, how that decision impacts our life, or should impact our life. Because if we do come to the conclusion that Jesus is the Son of God based on the evidence, if we just hold that as an intellectual proposition in our mind, yes, I believe that Jesus is the Son of God, but I don't believe in Jesus as the Son of God, it doesn't affect my life, then this whole exercise is pointless. So that's going to be the emphasis at the end of our lesson tonight, to talk about, how our decision impacts our life. Now, as we get into this lesson, I thought it might be interesting to look at a few what are called jury instructions. As I mentioned a while ago, a judge, after the jury gets all of the evidence and they're ready to go back into the jury room, or before they do, the judge will instruct them concerning the law, concerning their principles, guiding principles as jurors, and so forth. And so I thought it would be interesting just to look at some of those in line with what we've been talking about, impartiality and so forth. And these are just typical sorts of jury instructions that are given in various courts of law in the state and federal level. But one of them talks about, do not let any bias, sympathy, or prejudice that you feel toward one side or the other influence your decision in any way. That's just, you know, you need to approach the situation honestly. Each of you must decide the case for yourself, but only after a full and impartial consideration of all of the evidence with your fellow jurors. So if you're part of a jury, you're consulting with others, you're coming to some kind of mutual decision, if that's possible, and it should be based on consideration of all of the evidence that has been put before you and in consultation with others that are performing the same function there as you're on a jury together. Listen to each other carefully. In the course of your deliberations, you should feel free to re-examine your own views and to change your opinion based upon the evidence. So sometimes you may go into a particular case, you know, thinking of a particular thing, but the evidence may change your mind. That's what evidence is about, or that's what, you know, honesty is about, is if you hear evidence that you didn't know about before, or you weren't maybe called upon to evaluate before, but now you are, that, you know, you should make your decision in accordance with that evidence. That's how it's supposed to work. By the way, how many people have ever been on a jury in court? Wow. Well, there's a lot more hands than I would have expected. I've been called for jury duty a number of times. I show up, and lawyers always get kicked off of juries, so I never have been able to do that. That surprised me. There's a lot of people out there that have done this. You probably heard instructions like this then. Another one, and this is a continuation of the previous one about being impartial, about being willing to change your mind based on the evidence. It says, but you should not give up your honest convictions about the evidence just because of the opinions of your fellow jurors. So you shouldn't be unduly influenced by others. You should make your decision based on your understanding, based on your own sound reasoning. Nor should you change your mind just for the purpose of obtaining enough votes for a verdict. So, again, you shouldn't just go along with a crowd. You need to exercise your independent judgment. And so a lot of these principles, I think, are important as we think about the evidence for Jesus, because there are people around us who have opinions about Jesus or think they have opinions about Jesus. Maybe they haven't really heard the evidence that we've talked about, but they think they know who Jesus is or who Jesus was, and that's how they proceed with their life. And if we're not careful, we can be influenced by that attitude or by their decision without really honestly considering and making our own decision on the facts, on the evidence. So just some things to think about as we go further into this lesson. I wanted to go back to one thing that we touched on in the original lesson, and this has to do with just standards of proof. You know, we talk about whether something's been proved or not. Well, there are different levels of proof. Something may be possible, or it may be plausible. It may be likely, very likely, or certain. So there are those, you know, it's kind of a scale, if you will, of different levels of certainty about something. And I emphasized in our original lesson, I'll emphasize this again because I think it's important, that these various levels of proof do show up in our legal system in various ways. But one thing is that possibility is never sufficient under any circumstances for any proving anything in a court of law. Just go in and prove that something is possible is really not proving anything. You're just saying, yeah, it could have happened. You know, basically anything is possible. But, you know, how would you like to be accused of a crime and somebody just presented evidence that, yeah, it was possible that this person committed this crime. They were in the same city at the time when the crime occurred, and so it's possible they occurred that they did it. How would you like to be convicted on that evidence? Well, that's not enough. There has to be more than just possibility. Plausibility, that shows up in the context of a search warrant in our legal system, that if, you know, there's a reasonable suspicion that somebody's up to criminal activity, we have some facts that, you know, somebody has observed that we can put into a warrant, present it to a judge, and say, hey, judge, this causes us to suspect there's some criminal activity going on here. The judge, if the judge agrees that, yeah, that creates some suspicion there, then they will issue a warrant. You can go out and you can search somebody's property. So under the legal system, your right to privacy can be invaded just on the basis of plausibility, that there's some evidence here that kind of suggests, at least reasonably suggests, that something criminal is going on. You know, they can come in, they can search your house, they can go through all your trunks, all your drawers, all your whatever in your house, looking for what they are authorized to look for under the warrant. Likely, or more likely than not, is the standard in a civil case, like an auto accident. I'm in an auto accident, somebody sues me, they take me to court, and, you know, was the light green or was it red when I went through it? Well, you can have one witness that says, well, it looked red to me, and another says, well, no, it was green. So you have some conflict in the evidence, but the jury then has to weigh everything and say, well, we think this person is more believable than that person. So, you know, we'll say it's more likely than not that he ran the red light. You know, so in that, again, in the civil context, they can take away your property. They can take away, you know, impose damage, a damage verdict against you on the basis of just more likely than not. Now, in the criminal area, we have additional protections which relate to, you know, not putting somebody in jail, not depriving them of their freedom, or maybe even their life, based on just more likely than not. There has to be a higher standard. So it's usually phrased in terms of beyond a reasonable doubt. The evidence has been presented such that you can come to a firm conclusion that this is what happened, this is the person that did it, or whatever. And on that basis, if the conclusion is that it's beyond a reasonable doubt, then, again, that person's freedom can be taken away, they can be locked in jail, they can even be put to death, if that's, you know, depending on the nature of the crime and the law in that particular state or jurisdiction. So that's something that we have in our legal system based on that level of proof. And then it's interesting that in our legal system, certainty is never required. Absolute certainty, you don't have to prove that to prove anything in a court of law. That's never required. That's too high a standard. That the law recognizes is unreasonable to think that you can prove something beyond absolute certainty or to absolute certainty. So again, I just wanted to review those standards as we go through and look at the various things then that we've talked about. Well, we talked about in one lesson about did Jesus exist? Because, you know, most scholars accept that Jesus was a real person. He lived in a historical time back in the first century, but there are a few that question that. And so we looked in one lesson about the evidence regarding Jesus. Of course, we have biblical sources that talk about Jesus, talk about his life, talk about what he did. And most, just looking at those sources, think that that's enough to establish that Jesus existed, particularly the account of Jesus being crucified and being put to death in that way, because if you were going to make up a story about a Savior, would you make up a story about your Savior being put to death, being arrested, being beaten, being taken off and killed? No, that wouldn't make sense. So historians, just that's one principle they go by, that if something is contrary to normal thinking in that way, then that tends to make it reliable, that aspect of it. So just based on biblical sources, we could say that, but as we saw, there are a lot of other sources. Josephus, the Jewish historian, talks about Jesus, as well as Jesus' brother James and how James was put to death at a certain point in the early 60s A.D. We looked at Tacitus, the Roman historian, who recounted, Jesus and his crucifixion, some other basic facts about him. Same with the Roman historian Suetonius. and Pliny the Younger. Both of them talked about aspects of Jesus and his followers. Pliny the Younger talked about Jesus being worshipped as God, worshipped as a God. And so these various Roman historians, you know, they talk about Jesus, recognize him as a historical figure. Thallus and Phlegon of Tralles were two Greek philosophers who lived in the second century or late first century, and they tried to argue about Jesus and some events that occurred around the crucifixion, the darkness, the earthquakes. They were trying to make arguments about why those things didn't happen, or maybe there was some other explanation. But in doing that, they recognized the reality of those events. They also recognized, that Jesus was a historical person. Then there was a Mara Bar Serapion we talked about. It was a man who was writing his son and talked about Jesus as an example of injustice that had been done to a person. And then we saw rabbinic sources as well. Rabbis, the Jewish sources, talk about Jesus in various ways. So, did Jesus exist? Was he a real person? Or can we simply write him off as a myth? Well, if you look at the evidence, as we did, at least it's my conclusion, you can make up your own mind, beyond a reasonable doubt, Jesus lived. He was a real person. He's somebody that I have to deal with in my life from the standpoint of historical reality. I can't just say, well, I'm not going to even think about it because it's just a fabrication. So beyond a reasonable doubt is my judgment. And again, each one of us has to be the jury of our own hearts, of our own minds, of our own lives. Well, we then looked at who wrote the Gospels and when, and looked at various evidence around that. We saw that there are no anonymous copies of the Gospels. That was the theory that skeptics put forward, as the Gospels were just written by somebody that was not really an eyewitness or didn't have access to eyewitness information. They were just writing it down later. They made up the stories. And so we looked at how that, if that were true, then there should be anonymous copies of the Gospels out there, or at least there should be copies that had different names attached to them, because supposedly the names Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were attached to them 100 years or more later. So if that were true, the anonymous authorship of the Gospels was correct, then how can you explain that there is absolutely no anonymous copies, there are no misnamed copies of the Gospels out there? We also looked at some internal evidence regarding the Gospels and their authorship. The Gospels of Luke and John in particular have statements in them that are either, I'm looking at this, I saw this, you know, I'm an eyewitness to this, or that in the case of Luke, I had access to that eyewitness information. We also saw in all of the Gospels there are authorship clues from the standpoint of, you know, Luke was a doctor. We know his background as a doctor. In his gospel, the Gospel of Luke, we find a lot of medical terminology that we don't find in the other gospels, so that makes sense. With respect to Matthew, we see special references to taxes and terminology used in that area. Matthew, of course, was a tax collector. And we saw in the case of Mark that, you know, there were special details or specific details in that were indicative of eyewitness sort of testimony. And so, you know, again, the internal evidence as you look within the document is supportive of the authorship of those gospels by the eyewitnesses or the others who, in the case of Mark and Luke, had access to those eyewitnesses. And then external evidence, we saw that Papias, Irenaeus of Lyons, various other early authors in the second century recorded that, you know, these various Gospels were written by these individuals as we know them. And again, there's been no confusion whatsoever around who wrote the Gospels. The evidence is absolutely consistent in that regard. You never have anybody pointing to the Gospel of Matthew and saying that was written by John, or the Gospel of John and saying that was written by Mark, or anything like that. Always, it's been understood clearly and without equivocation concerning the authorship of the Gospels and their being eyewitnesses or being first century individuals. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. So as I look at that evidence, again, looking at it honestly and saying, what am I going to believe about that? Or what are the facts about that? My verdict is beyond a reasonable doubt. These Gospels were written by people who were there or who had access to the eyewitnesses. And for that reason, it's based on reliable information, eyewitness information. Well, we also talked about the New Testament documents, and, some question, do we really have what the original writers of the Gospels wrote? We don't have the original documents. Those have been lost. Those have been destroyed by time or some persecution, perhaps, because there were times specifically with respect to Roman persecutions where there was a concerted effort to destroy the documents of the Christian faith. And so some have questioned, do we really have what the Gospel writers wrote in the documents that we have from which we derive our New Testament today? And as we saw, and I like this phrase because I think it's a very great description of the state of the evidence in that regard, we have an embarrassment of riches, according to Dr. Daniel Wallace, who's a New Testament scholar, who is, I mentioned he has a website. He's one of his main things that he's doing is going around throughout the world and photographing all of the various New Testament documents, and he's making those available on his website. This guy is a bona fide scholar. He's not some fly-by-night person, so this person knows what he's talking about, and indeed, he calls what we have with respect to the manuscript evidence of the Greek New Testament an embarrassment of riches because there's so much compared to other ancient documents. The New Testament, by far, is the best attested document there is. There's more documentary support for that than any other document, by far. And we saw that there are more than 5,800 Greek manuscripts of the Greek New Testament. And these start with fragments dating as early as 125, maybe a little bit before that. There are other documents that are being found all the time. There's some now that are being looked at that may date to the late first century, the Gospel of Mark. And so, the time period between the originals and the first copies that we have in the case of the New Testament is an extremely short period. We're talking less than 100 years. And in the case of the Gospel of John, which is currently the earliest document that we have, it was less than 30 years from when the original was written. 125, the Gospel of John was probably written about 96. So again, that's a way in which the New Testament documents is different from other ancient documents where you'll have centuries and centuries, sometimes millennia between the originals and the first copies that we still have. There are also 24,000 plus ancient texts in other languages, such as Syriac, Aramaic, Coptic, etc., that have New Testament passages in them, or are copies of in that other language of the New Testament text. Those can be used as well to support the original text. So, again, just a huge volume of information, so much so that it's difficult to collate and track it all. And we also saw how that as you compare the various manuscripts, there are differences between them. The vast majority of those are spelling sorts of things, maybe word order, which doesn't matter in Greek, other things of that sure that are trivial. They have absolutely no impact on the meaning of the text whatsoever. That's 99%+ of the differences that you see in the text. So there's an extremely high degree of proof or confidence regarding the validity of the text that we now have. There are some things that, you know, there are differences in wording that do make some substantive difference from the standpoint of the text, but none of that has any impact whatsoever on any essential doctrine in the New Testament. They're just things that really have no substantive meaning in terms of the interpretation or the application of the text. So again, based on the evidence that we have, which is huge, my conclusion that beyond a reasonable doubt, the New Testament that I hold in my hand is based on a Greek text that was the original text, without any possibility of error there with respect to any essential matter that we have to rely on to have our faith or to live our Christian life. We also looked at the Gospels and whether they are trustworthy. Some say, okay, we have the original text of the Gospels and the other documents we have in the New Testament, I'll give you that, but, you know, the Gospels, they tell the same story, and some of them include this detail, some of them include that detail, or they'll even say that there are, you know, there are differences that are contradictions. And so they attempt to attack the trustworthiness of the Gospels, even if the text we have cannot really be attacked on that basis. So we saw how that the Gospels, they were written by competent adults, people who were there, eyewitnesses, who had good information. We also looked at these people in terms of their willingness to go to their death for what they were teaching, for what they believed there in the first century. You know, in our country today, with freedom of religion being a basic fundamental right, none of us, or few of us, have experienced real physical sorts of persecution. We probably all have experienced persecution in some way. I know I have. Being a Christian in various contexts is not a thing that wins you friends or influences people in a worldly standpoint. So we've all been persecuted from that standpoint, but these people didn't just face being excluded from a group or being laughed at or something. They faced being put in prison, being mistreated, and ultimately put to death. And they were faithful despite that. So those two facts give you some fairly significant confidence to start out with that these people were not just blowing smoke when they wrote the Gospels. They were writing what they understood to be the truth. We also looked at how that the differences in the Gospels, as you look at them, they overlap in a lot of ways. They tell the same stories, but there are differences from the standpoint of one will include a detail that the other one doesn't. And we saw how that's not a contradiction. That's what you would expect from real eyewitness testimony. There are going to be differences. I see this all the time in my work as a lawyer. You know, you get two people up on the stand, they testify about the same event. They don't use exactly the same words. They don't use exactly the same description of what happened. Maybe they rearrange the order in places, or they have a little different perspective, so one gives a little more information than the other. Those sorts of differences, which is really what we see in the Gospels, are a strong indication of reliability, not of contradictions. So that's an important thing to understand, that these kinds of differences show true credibility and reliability of a witness. If they all said the same thing, or let's say we just had one document, and then at the bottom you had signed Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, what good would that be? You would simply have four people that are signing a statement that somebody wrote saying this is what happened. But when you have four different documents stated in their own terms, stated, you know, in some cases differently with different details that, again, they mesh, but they're not the same. That's a much stronger case. Those are independent witnesses, independent attestation to the different things that they're talking about. That's extremely important to historians when they're trying to decide what's true, what's factual based on information that we have coming to us from the ancient world. So that's a very strong point. Another thing that we have, though, that we do have ultimate consistency between those things. You can put them together. They mesh. Yeah, some include some details, some not. But, you know, again, that's not a contradiction. So their consistency, your ability to see that, yeah, okay, I can see how that fits together, even though the details aren't exactly the same from one to the other, the ability to do that shows reliability. Again, see this all the time in the legal field with respect to witnesses. If their testimony meshes, even though it's not exactly the same, that shows that's evidence of reliability. Another thing that we looked at that's very interesting are undesigned coincidences. And we saw how in some of the Gospels, one statement will be made. One example that we gave was in the Gospel of Matthew, I believe it was. It talks about how Jesus was on trial before the Sanhedrin. Somebody came up and slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who just slapped you?" And from that gospel, you would just say, well, why didn't Jesus just look at him and say, hey, you did? What you find from another gospel is that Jesus was actually blindfolded at the time. So, you know, again, the gospels fit together in that way. Sometimes they supply details that another doesn't that helps you understand the full picture. And so, these sorts of undesigned coincidences, and by that we're saying that, you know, you don't have one gospel writer saying, oh, there's another gospel over here that left out this detail. I'm going to put it in for you. It's just telling the story, and it tells a detail that some other gospel doesn't. And so it's not a designed coincidence. It's not intended to fill in that gap. It just does inadvertently. To me, that shows that there's an author underlying the four authors of the gospels. In other words, there's the Holy Spirit underlying it. That helps to coordinate that information and provide a complete picture as you look at the whole put together. So, are the Gospels trustworthy? I mean, there's much more we could look at here. There's verification from archaeology regarding the places, the people, and so forth, the first century political situation, all of those things as they are referenced in the Gospel documents. Archaeological discoveries have verified that information. And so, you know, there's more that we could go into. There's more evidence out there. But just based on what we have, again, my conclusion, beyond a reasonable doubt, those gospel documents, I think, are reliable. I can't just ignore them. We've talked in a couple of the lessons about a man named J. Warner Wallace, who was a cold case detective, originally an atheist. And one of his fellow employees challenged him to look at the Gospels, to look at Jesus and who he was. And he, with his cold case investigator background, started looking at the Gospels and saw how that, hey, this is really looking, these different Gospels, like real eyewitness testimony. You know, this is what real eyewitness testimony looks like in a cold case that he's dealing with and trying to solve. And he could see how things fit together. He could see these unexplained coordination of the various Gospels, and that's something that he found particularly convincing from his background in that field where he came from. So to me, this is a very important point that as well that shows the reliability and trustworthiness of the gospel documents. Then we looked last time at the question, did Jesus rise from the dead? Because this, as we saw, is an important factor in the Gospels. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, it's It's the basic foundational fact upon which the gospel is proclaimed, the resurrection of Jesus. If that didn't happen, then we're telling you, or we've told you, a false story. So it's important to the gospel story, and so we looked at the evidence concerning that. And we saw, basically, there are certain facts that are indisputable or undeniable on a reasonable basis, undeniable. Jesus died on the cross. Again, that's not a fact somebody would make up if you're trying to make up a Savior. So Jesus died on the cross. Historians will agree about that. Jesus was buried. The burial was by Joseph of Arimathea, the Gospels say. Anybody know who Joseph of Arimathea was? What group he belonged to? He was a Pharisee. He was part of the Sanhedrin. Well, who was it that condemned Jesus to death? The Sanhedrin. So again, if you were making up a story about the burial, would you pick somebody who was you viewed as part of that group that killed your Savior and give him a compliment by saying he was the one that gave Jesus an honorable burial? No, that probably not. So again, the idea of that Jesus was buried is supported by that historical principle. The tomb was empty. No real dispute there. Because if it wasn't empty, then the enemies of the early Christians could have simply produced the body and ended the whole discussion about the resurrection and about Christianity. Also, we know historically that the disciples reported Jesus as being raised from the dead, and that they then went out, they preached that fact, they witnessed to that fact, and it was a transformative event in their life to the point that, again, they were willing to die for that testimony, for that statement. So those facts really, from a historical standpoint, can't reasonably be refuted. Well, what's the reasonable conclusion from that? Really, there's only one reasonable conclusion we saw from our lesson. The idea that the disciples lied, that they stole the body and then made up this story about Jesus' resurrection, they went out and proclaimed that and died for that, is ridiculous. I mean, somebody may die for something that's false, but some people don't die for something that they know is false and that they're lying about without any other motivation for doing so. So there really is only one reasonable conclusion for the resurrection of Jesus or these five irrefutable facts, and that is the resurrection of Jesus. So again, beyond a reasonable doubt, in my book, there just really is no other reasonable explanation. Various things are tossed out there, but none of them holds water as you start investigating it further. Well, that brings us down really to the end of our lesson tonight then, and brings us to the point of decision. You know, that we've seen the evidence. Time now to make a decision. Each one of us in our individual role as the jury of our own lives. So one thing I wanted to talk about when we face the question, what do we do with this evidence? The evidence is out there. You know, it's a reality. We have to somehow deal with it if we're going to be honest. Now, people can be dishonest and just say, I'm not going to think about it. I'm just going to ignore it. Yeah, you can do that. You can live your life that way, but that's a very dangerous way to live. You're not being truthful. You're not really living up to the facts. Well, one thing I wanted to emphasize as we look about the evidence concerning Jesus is that it ultimately matters in our lives. And if we, you know, some people may have a belief in their mind that, yeah, okay, that makes sense. I believe that Jesus lived, that the Gospels are reliable, that, you know, even that the best explanation for the empty tomb is Jesus' resurrection. So I believe that's the only real explanation for that evidence. That's the best explanation. But maybe they don't have a belief in Jesus. If those facts are true, if the resurrection of Jesus is true, if the Gospels are accurate, if Jesus was a real person that we have to deal with, then we have to deal with that. it should have an impact on our lives. And ultimately, of course, as we read the rest of the New Testament and the Gospels themselves, the goal of those things in our lives is for us to believe in the gospel, to believe in Jesus, not just believe that there's factual information out there, but that information has to get into our heart and it has to impact us if we're going to be honest about the situation. And we can look at various verses. We're a little short on time, so I'm not going to go into reading all of these, but one I will read is John chapter 7. Turn over there, because this is a passage that really points out that, you know, we've talked about a lot of evidence, and that can be kind of cold and clinical from the standpoint of, yeah, you know, there are these facts out there, and what do we make of those? But Jesus makes an interesting statement, particularly, and let's look at verse 17. Various people were saying, hey, this Jesus, he's up there teaching. What's he doing up there teaching? He never was formally educated like the rabbis. And so, you know, they were questioning the reliability of his teaching or his authority. Jesus says in verse 17, if anyone is willing to do his will, he will know of the teaching, whether it is of God or whether I speak for myself. This is really another important piece of evidence for the Christian, that when you start living the life, when you start reading the teachings of Jesus and applying them to your life and seeing how that impacts your life, seeing how that impacts your outlook, seeing how that impacts your relationships, seeing how that impacts everything in your life, that's some pretty strong evidence in itself that there's something to this gospel stuff. It's not just some story that somebody made up and, you know, that we can just kind of dismiss. I've heard it said, and I very much think it's true, that it would take a Jesus Christ to make up the things that Jesus Christ said. Because those things are so amazing, so impactful on our lives, that again, Jesus gives us a challenge. Put these into your life and start living them, and then tell me they're false. That's Jesus' challenge, and so that would be my challenge to us tonight, to not just look at what we've talked about from the standpoint of, yeah, it's information, interesting, that's a pretty good argument, but put it into our hearts, put it into our lives, and let it have its impact there, let it have its full flower there in our life. These other verses talk about other aspects that Jesus gave, challenges that he made, as we look at the Gospels. Sacrificing is believing. Jesus there emphasized in that passage, that was with the young, the rich young ruler came to Jesus, wanted to know what he had to do to be saved, and Jesus said, well, do the commandments. He says, I've done that. And Jesus says, okay, if you want to really get down to the nub of it, go and sell everything you have, come follow me. And the guy said, oh, I don't want to do that. That's too much. And so he went away sorrowful, but Jesus gave him that sort of a challenge. And he gives that to each of us. Not that each of us, Jesus isn't commanding each of us to go out and sell everything that we have and, you know, live off of somebody else. We're taught that we should take care of ourselves. But Jesus saw that as that particular man's problem. Yeah, he was a good person. He obeyed the commandments, but he had this one thing he was hanging on to. Jesus poked at that, and that man was unable to accept that challenge. But that's a challenge we all have to face in our lives. Giving is believing. Matthew 25 talks about the judgment scene there and how Jesus talks to various people and says that because you've done this, that, and the other with respect to your brethren, you've done it to me. You know, you've given them food, you've given them clothing, you've given them shelter. So that's a challenge of living the Christian life that Jesus puts forward. Enduring is believing as well. You know, continuing on, being faithful throughout our lives and in death. So the reason I put this up here is just to emphasize that we're not talking here just about an intellectual exercise. or that we're making a decision like in a jury that only affects somebody else. We're passing judgment on someone else. We're really looking at our own lives, our own selves, and it's only when we truly accept the challenges that Jesus gives us that we get the full impact of what the gospel is all about. And then, in closing, I'd just like to put a few words up on the screen here after we're done looking at these words, and I'm just going to read each one of them. And I want each one of us, as we see that word, this is particularly for those of you who are already Christians, think about, is that something that's in my life? Is that something that describes me? Because in Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 through 24, the Apostle Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit. The Holy Spirit gives us the instruction, gives us the word. And as we put that into our hearts, as we put that into our lives, as we live it out, then it should have certain fruit. It should have certain effects in our lives that are visible to ourselves and to others around us. So after we look at these various words, we all are familiar with them, but I want each of us to look at these individually, one by one, and think about, does that describe me? After we do that, we'll have our invitation song. So Paul says, list the fruit of the Spirit. He says, love. Agape love. Always doing what is in the best interests, properly understood, of those around us. Joy. Not a giddy sort of joy, but an internal contentment and happiness. Peace. Having peace with God, being reconciled with God, reconciled within yourself. Patience. Having the fortitude to carry on, to continue to do what God wants us to do, and waiting for the ultimate outcome of His grace in our lives. Kindness. Just being nice to other people, thinking about someone else, not just ourselves. Goodness. You know, do we really have an attitude of wanting to help other people, wanting to be good? And do we have a clean mind, a clean perspective on life that the gospel challenges us to have? Faithfulness. Are we living consistently in our life with what we know to be true? Not that we're, you know, perfect, but are we living in a way that exhibits faith? Gentleness or meekness, the idea of strength under control, being able to control our emotions, control our the way we react to people. And finally, self-control. Are we able to take ourselves and tell ourselves, this is what I'm going to do, and then carry that out? That's a hard thing to do. Hard thing to do. Paul ends this list by saying, against such things there is no law. That's always been an impressive statement to me. That these things, you can't go to the statute books, the criminal statutes, and find any of these outlawed. Why? Because they're good things. They're things that people know we ought to do, and that the gospel instructs us to do. But these are the challenges that the gospel gives us. So tonight, I hope that you have been encouraged by the evidence that we've looked at, by the things we've talked about. If you're not a Christian tonight, we would invite you to make that decision to, as the jury of your own life, decide, this is going to be my verdict. This is going to be how I live my life. This is what's going to guide my life, and take up the challenge that the gospel gives us. If you are a Christian, then, you know, we each need to renew that commitment, that challenge, the acceptance of that challenge each day. So won't you come as we stand and sing together the invitation song?